Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. It's been that for a long time. 2009. Still going at it. I'm back home for a few days, a little bit, a while. It's nice. It's nice to come back. I'm living the life. Traveling up to Canada, doing the acting, coming back, doing the catting. The catting? I don't know what that means. I don't know how people stay away from home for very long when they have actual kids. But, like, I fucking worry about my cats like some sort of idiot. I did get, by the way, I'm not humble bragging, but I did get voted Cat Dad of the Year by PETA. I finally won something. You know, I rarely win anything. And I am honored, and I'm happy to be that. But I imagine that just by the amount that I worry about my dumb cats, that if I had kids, I'd be out of my mind. I do think I made the right decision on that. I do think I'm a little too panicky. Not that I'd be, a helicopter parent, but I'd be very panicky. I think my parents were panicky. They were worried all the time about every little thing. I don't know that they were that capable of the nurturing sort of love, let's get this kid up and running business, but I think they were terrified of something happening to me because of what that might put them through. And I'm projecting, but nonetheless, I do worry about the cats, and they're fine. I don't know what, I think they're not going to remember me. And it's hard with cats anyways to determine whether they're excited or not. A lot of people say, well, you got to get a dog if you want something that gets excited to see you. Cats, you got to decode. You got to figure it out. Like, yeah, that seems exciting. He seems excited. Look, he came over. And, oh, he's walking away. But that I think that moment when he came over when I got home, he was definitely excited. Oh, see, look, he turned over on his back for a second. Oh, he's excited to see me. That one just ran over to where I feed him. All right. Well, that's exciting. He's excited about something at least. I had this thought years ago. I might have done it as a joke somewhere. When you leave, if you're gone for a couple of days, I don't know what the cat brain is capable of, but I assume they just imagine you're dead, or not even imagine it. They're just sort of like, well, it's been 3 days. I guess he's dead. I don't think they process it like that. I don't think they're that, you know, sociopathic necessarily, but something in their ancient brain must be like, well, this happens. You know, we've lost a lot over the years. You never know with us when one's going to wander out the door and not come back. And I guess that big one, he just, I don't know, a car, a coyote, something. He's in a ditch somewhere. He's gone. And I always thought that they just assume you're dead. So when you come back, no matter how long you've been away, it's kind of like a miracle. Yeah, I think there must be a moment where they're like, this is amazing. We all thought you were dead, and now you're back, and we're hungry. So good timing on that. All right, well, today I talked to Jude Law. We went over there, me and Brendan, when I was in New York last, and we went to his production offices over at Steiner Studios. And, we sat down in a conference room and we did the thing. And it was pretty great. He's a good guy. And also this new movie he's in, Firebrand, it's playing now. He plays Henry VIII, and it's a kind of a monster. You know, I mean, I think he had I talked to him about it. They definitely had to strap some fat onto him. But I believe I brought up the fact that they might have had a stunt ass in there. I believe there's an ass in one shot, and it wasn't Jude's ass. I mean, I didn't have him prove that, but I'm pretty sure. But he's a solid dude. And this movie is kind of great. And it's one of these movies where so many movies happen that we don't even fucking know about. And it's annoying. And it's annoying also that, you know, I spent like a half hour with Kit on the couch last night trying to figure out a movie to watch. How many times do you actually go back to movies you've seen before? At least once. It's crazy. We were just looking, and there's some part of me that's sort of like, I don't know what that is. Doesn't look good. The picture, that's a silly trailer. I can't. And I just blow past so many movies, and we ended up watching Capricorn 1, which is not a great movie. The point was, is I don't see a lot of movies, a lot of new movies, because there's so many of them out there, and I don't know which one to watch. But this movie, Firebrand, it kind of gets the period amazing. It's about Henry VIII's last wife, who was kind of a rebel, you know, kind of a fighter for the people. It's kind of a great movie. Jude does an amazing job. And we also talk a bit about The Order, which is a movie I was in that he produced, his company. That's the one where I played Alan Berg. It's about The Order, the first sort of murderous domestic terrorist organization, white supremacists. And they were up in, where were they? Washington, I think. But they dispatched an assassin to kill this this Jewish radio host. The movie and play talk radio is sort of based on Berg, but he was a real guy. And I got offered the role of Berg. And the entire part is really just me getting gunned down in my driveway with some stuff on the mic. But it was pretty disturbing. And I've yet to see the movie. Why have I not seen the movie? But Jude said it's good. So when that shows up on the menu of one of the streaming services that I have and I'm flipping through it, maybe I'll get a chance to watch it. But Jude was great. This week, I have a show in Vancouver on Friday, June 21st at the Vogue Theater. I believe that's sold out. Then I'm in Seattle on Saturday, June 22nd, the next day at the Moore Theater. That may be sold out, but I don't know. And I'll be in Phoenix, Arizona at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. You can go to WTFpod.com for tickets. There's more dates there, too. Check them out. I'm getting after the TV shoot. I got to get back into it because I got to get ready and get this stuff tuned up for a special that looks like it might happen. What is going on? How was Father's Day for you? I called my dad and it registered, which is good, but I don't think it's going great over there. It's hard, you know. It's a blessing, I guess, that my parents had me when they were children, that because of that, there's a very small age difference between us now, me and my parents, and they're both around, but not going great. Not going great. I'll get into that. What are your memories of your dad? That was what I was trying to figure out. What is it? What do you got to do to put it together, your relationship with them? And, you know, what's it built on? Do you know what I mean? I mean, many of you know who've been listening to me for years that, you know, there were times where I had tremendous difficulties with the guy. You know, we went head to head many times, and it wasn't good. And there was a period of time where I didn't talk to the guy for over a year. Yeah, maybe. He didn't talk to me either. But I don't know. Sometimes you have to do that. I had a therapist once, and maybe this is helpful, I don't know, who said, you know, you can train your parents because ultimately they're going to want to have a relationship with you. And that may work for some dynamics, and, you know, it definitely worked for mine, but it's an interesting idea. That you get to a certain age, you're a grown person, and you can tell them to fuck off. And there's a real good chance that they'll eventually buckle and, you know, at least negotiate with you on the terms of the dynamic. I keep thinking back about the things I remember about my father going back as far as I can remember. And I got to be honest with you, none of them great. None of them that good. There's many times the things I remember are... Well, you know, I have this really weird memory of going skiing with my parents. We're on the ticket line, and the guy who's taking tickets had a hoarse voice. And my dad just said out of nowhere, it's like, probably syphilis of the throat. And I'm like, what? And I, for some reason, that stands out in my mind. And then there was a time where we were skiing another time, and I had those Cubco bindings, which were supposed to be the safest binding, and they kept falling off, so my dad tightened them up, and the next time I fell, I got a spiral fracture, kind of corkscrewed my tibia, and he was an orthopedic, and I just remember that drive home. I had a splint, and they threw me in the back of the Blazer, which was the bumpiest ride ever, and it was just awful. And then he set my leg. I had a waist cast for months, and then a shorter cast for a bit longer. I remember I went to see George Carlin when I had the shorter cast. Yeah, that was a good memory. It's better than the memory of my dad breaking my leg. But I don't recall any physical therapy. And to this day, my right foot splays out, not right, because it was broken. And my doctor dad, I guess they didn't have physical therapy then. I don't know. And then I remember the time he ran over my foot. Yeah, these are the great memories and why I make sure I always call him on Father's Day. And then there was the manic episode. Those were actually the most exciting. You know, he'd get very involved with things, you know, whether it was hats. There was a period there where everyone was wearing hats. My parents had gone to New Orleans and he got a bunch of these hats. There was all of those times where he was manic and couldn't find a wrench. Not a great day. Not a great day. But I think ultimately, as you get older, the best thing you can do is try to figure out the basic vibe or energy or part of your parent that you might possess that is good, that gets you through life, that helps you do things, that, you know, that somehow it was given to you. It was passed on, and it turns out it was not a bad thing. A lot of those things seem bad, but then you just got to trim them up, trim off the bad part and say, like, well, at the core of this, once you get it trimmed up, it's not a bad thing. Manic charm, not bad for a comic. Engaged in life in a very excited, sometimes angry way. Not bad once you take out the bad memories and, you know, the mental illness part of it. Not bad at all. Yeah, then there's the times where I remember, well, how about my graduation for college? My dad was on a down then. He was a bit depressed. He was a little bipolar, my old man. And that day was not a good day. He wandered off the day of my graduation, and we didn't know where he went. And we were just shy of calling the police, and he showed back up. I guess he had walked to a bridge and did some thinking and decided against it and came back. It made my graduation day memorable. And yeah, it's good, you know, when you have that parent that's that weird combination of mentally off and also, you know, utterly self-centered. Because ultimately all these memories come back to him. And then there were the times when he was depressed and my mother used to say, why don't you go make him laugh? You're the only one that can. And that was the beginning of my life as a comedian. Thanks, Dad. Happy Father's Day. So look, I will be going back to shoot some more in Canada and you'll hear me from there. But today I'm here and I've done some great interviews in the past few days that you'll hear. I finally buckled after years of pestering from Fish fans and sat down with Trey Anastasio. And it turned out to be really good, even though I'm not a Fish guy. We discussed it, but that's coming up. There's a lot of great other episodes coming up. But today we have Jude Law. And again, I want to mention that Firebrand is playing in theaters and it's a great period piece. And this was a great conversation with Jude Law.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
You know how to hold a mic?
Yep.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah, I don't know where all of a sudden time is just screaming by. For years, I was like, you know, everyone talks about how fast it goes by, and I'm like, I'm not feeling it. And then I turned 60, and I'm like, where the fuck did it go?
Yeah.
And you feel it pressing down on you.
Yeah. You do. Yeah. You really do. It's It's an unusual thing. It's an elastic thing, time, though.
Yes.
I always love those perspectives back, where on the one hand, you feel like you've just sped through years of your life, and then you look at it in more detail, and actually you go, actually, no, I've done a fair amount, or oh, that was a good experience, you know? And
right.
So it kind of it contracts and expands
yeah.
in equal yeah. measure.
Yeah. But the one thing underneath it all is like, it's behind me.
One thing behind it all is it's disappearing.
Exactly.
We're all heading in one direction.
That's right.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
way out. No. And half your brain just spends a lot of time trying to stop you from thinking about that
yeah.
specifically.
Yeah.
So.
And there are a lot of reminders.
Yeah.
Keep
yeah.
popping up.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's kids growing up or parents getting older or partners getting, you know.
I know. I think that has something to do with, too. My parents are, you know, kind of in decline. Yours?
Yeah.
How old are they?
Dad's 81, mum's 77, but my mum's not very well.
Yeah.
And but dad's fighting fit.
Yeah.
And doing an amazing job looking after my mum. But yeah, it's tough.
I know. And then you start to, yeah, I don't know, man. It's hard not to get existentially negative, you know, because yeah. you're like, well, so that's the best it can go.
Shit. I know.
That's
I know.
What you just said to me is like, that's the best. One of them's still good enough to take care of the other.
That's about as good as it gets.
Yeah, right. yeah.
It's true. It's true.
And
yeah.
do you spend time with them?
Yeah,
yeah,
I do. I mean, it's been an unusual year. I'm sure that it'll come up while we talk more. I've been away a lot this year with the kids and just on the road.
Yeah.
But we're a very close-knit family. So on the whole, yeah, we spend time together and make sure we see each other.
Yeah, I don't know how. I'm still trying to like wrap my brain around how actors do it, because I do the acting a bit. How'd that movie come out? I'm in your movie.
I've got to say, thank you so much for doing it.
Sure.
You gave it such legitimacy, and it, you know, there was a beautiful kind of pairing also with your voice and who you are,
right.
and what that great character was, yes. who he was. And
yeah.
It just, it gives it a really important sort of thread.
Oh, good.
Of, have you seen it yet?
No.
Oh, it's terrific.
So wait, now we're talking about The Order. And
yes.
like, how did you get involved with that?
The Order came about as seems to be the way at the moment. My producing partner, Ben,
yeah.
we have a company called Riff Raff, and more I've started kind of reaching out to writers and trying to create our own
yeah.
Material. Zach Balin, who is the writer, knows my producing partner. He
right.
sent me the script. It was a wonderful script. And
yeah.
We got involved as a production company several years ago, and then we're lucky enough that Justin Kurzel got on board.
He's intense.
He's intense. He's smart. He doesn't shy away from hitting things clean and
yeah.
true.
Yeah, he had me going there with that one. It was so funny because I get this opportunity. Someone asked me, like, you know, do you want to play Alan Berg? And I know who Alan Berg was before,
yeah.
right? But I didn't know, you know, a ton about him. I hadn't done a deep dive, but I knew that he was the guy that got assassinated, you know, by
That's
the
right.
Order. And he was a left-leaning radio personality before there were radio personalities like that.
Yeah, he'd really made his name
right.
in that.
So they said, do you want to play Alan Berg? And I'm like, who else is going to play it? I have to. There's no one else is going to play that role.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was what we were hoping you'd say or think. Yeah.
Because, like, I just thought, like, because honestly, a day doesn't go by where I don't feel like I'm going to be gunned down for being a Jew. So I thought maybe if I do it in a movie, it'll correct my karma.
Do you really feel like that?
Sometimes. But I'm also paranoid and have a hyper imagination that never goes in the right direction. My imagination, if it only worked for me in a positive way, I'd be a much healthier person. But
God damn it.
Yeah. But no.
I know what you mean when you talk about that. Imagination. So you know, I'm like, I've been doing this job, you know, pretending to be other people for 30 years. And my ability at being able to pretend I'm going through certain experiences that I'm not has gotten better and better and better, as one would hope it would
right.
the longer you do the job.
Yeah.
The problem now is it's out of control, because now if I just think too long on something, you know, it starts to really...
You live in it?
I kind of living it and start welling up or getting paranoid. So it's like a muscle. You've got to be really careful how you exercise
right.
that muscle.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Because it could just run away with you.
It runs
yeah.
away.
It's like, you know, I talk about... I do a bit on stage where the idea is that these people that are going crazy with QAnon or right wing, or they're literally psychotic in terms of the information that they're taking in and believing.
Yeah.
And the idea is that, like, you know, if you believe in God, on some level, you'll believe anything. So
yeah,
right, because that's a pretty big suspension of disbelief, right? So once that door is open, you've got to be kind of vigilant.
Yes.
About what goes in and out. And in the same way, I imagine, especially if, well, I don't know, like lately, because I'm getting older, there's a fragility to my sense of self that you kind of build your whole life around avoiding.
Mm.
And I think acting is one of those things that enables you to not be whatever you are and to whatever level of panic you are in. But I mean, do you find that the reason that you can't unlock from a certain way of thinking because of a character is because you want to avoid yourself?
I think the journey somehow of trying to lose myself and understand others more and more, which I've always seen as a really positive thing, a positive offshoot of acting, has become it's not like it defines me, but somewhere in that weird quagmire is who I am.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it shed light on who I am.
Yeah.
But it in fact, almost the opposite, in that it sort of is who I am. I'm the guy kind of pretending to be someone else, trying to find myself. Well, does that make any sense?
It does. It makes a lot of sense, because like, you're one of those guys who can, you know, you can carry a movie, but you can also do character work that's like not necessarily the lead of the movie. And you're kind of a mysterious guy. And I don't know if that's on purpose, but it's good. It's good as an actor.
I couldn't be more thrilled that you say that.
Well, you don't want to be...
I don't want anyone to know who I am.
Right.
But I don't know who I am. I mean, what a nightmare for everyone to say, oh, we know who you are.
Right. But that is, on some level, the essence of what a movie star is, right? And different from an actor. I mean, some movie stars are good actors. Mm. But usually, if someone's a movie star, like if you go see Clooney in something, you're like, well, that's Clooney doing a thing.
Mm. Mm.
When I just saw Firebrand, I'm like, that's Jude Law? How is that fucking possible?
Mm.
Like, you know what I mean? You have a freedom, and I don't know if you worked on it, to be, you know, a great actor as opposed to be a personality.
That was always my hope. Honestly, I couldn't be happier that you're saying this. Not as some sort of, you know, desperate need to be complimented, but it means a huge amount, because, if I can remember who I was as an actor, or my aspirations as an actor when I was a kid.
Yeah,
I grew up in Southeast London.
Give me the character of Southeast London, because that doesn't mean
Southeast
anything.
London is, well, it's quite hard to describe, really. It was always quite a kind of rough part of London. It's got sort of upwardly mobile areas. My parents went to university there. They were both from working class backgrounds. They kind of got themselves a great education and became middle class. And so we grew up in a sort of an aspirational bohemian kind of community. But it was, you know, it was also a lot of working class folk around us.
Yeah.
Same part of town that Gary Oldman grew up and Tim Roth, and they were always big heroes of mine.
So they're a little older than us.
They're a little older, and
they're probably my age. Like, I'm 60.
I'm not sure how old he is. Yeah, I think maybe a little old. I'm not sure. Actually.
So are we talking Mike Lee Land?
Yeah, I guess. Although Mike's from the north of England, and his films are. I'm trying to think. I can't really place any particular film or character. Well, Michael Caine was from up the road.
He's the best.
He's from Michael Caine and Harold Pinter were from Elephant and Castle, which was just up from where I was. I was a little further south. But those kind of character actors, the sort of work I saw Gary doing when I was a really, you know, aspiring young kind of wannabe kid at school, dreaming of being some kind of actor in some kind of form, were those guys who could disappear and try, you know, just sort of lose themselves in characters and not hide, but, you know, find a truth that was so far removed from who you were that people wouldn't know it was you. And I've always loved the idea of that.
Yeah.
And then as you get more entrenched in the business, you also realize there's another avenue, which is just sort of gloss, a kind of glossy version where you use what skill sets you have and you just play a type and, right. and that can work too.
Right.
You know, yeah. to me, the joy has always been the two opportunities. You can kind of disappear sure. in character. You can play the kind of movie star role. You do yeah. the indies, you do the franchises.
Yeah.
I mean, so try and do them all.
For yeah.
me, it was always.
There was never a point where you're like, I'm not doing that.
I don't think I've ever said that, which is has been to my detriment, honestly. And has also sometimes been a triumph.
Right. So there's party that's sort of like, oh, they want me. I guess I got to go.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah. I think I'm always worried this could be the last call.
Really?
I'm getting a little better at really stopping for a moment and looking at the kind of elements and thinking. Because you know what it is? The older I get... You know, the effort. It does take a lot of effort.
I'm exhausted
all
the time.
New project. Page one. How do we do this? And also, I get more and more nervous now.
Yeah.
I trust the process more, but oh, my goodness. So I've just started this show here.
Yeah.
We're in the production office for it. Started 2 weeks ago. The week before, I was chewing myself up. I didn't know whether I could, you know.
What's the character?
He's a guy who was in a band in the 90s. And he and his brother kind of kamikazed the band with drugs and yeah. ODing and all sorts of mess. And then they set up a bar that became the New York hotspot. The brother tries to kamikaze that. He gets bought out and sent away. And it's about him coming back and sort of leaning and bringing all his crap onto the brother's success.
So it's sort of like it's this new trend of restaurant bar centered.
I know, there's a lot of them. I guess there's such theater in them,
it's
right?
The bear too, I think.
There's a lot of emotion going on and family. And what's interesting is, of course, a lot of people that work in these places yes. are actors or singers.
Course, or they have been.
Or performers yeah. or have been. And there's a sense of, okay, the show goes up when the door opens.
That's right.
You know, totally. The clientele are our audience.
Totally.
When, you know, lights go out, everyone goes, do it again tomorrow, folks.
Right.
You know, and there's sometimes a lot of theater.
When you're in a bar or a restaurant, you kind of feel that they're not loving their role.
Not loving their role. They're for the money.
Yeah. So what were you afraid of?
Oh, everything. Can I do it? Have I got it in me?
Oh, yeah.
Just, is this going to be honest? Am I going to let everyone down?
Honest.
Have I got the energy? You know, it's. I'm proud that I still have a high bar. Like I always want things. I don't want to just phone something in or be like,
can you?
I really care about shit.
But can you phone in?
I don't think I can. I don't think I allow myself. I think that's the point of all the nerves and the sort of self-analysis and the upset prior to starting. And then we start, and of course I'm like, oh, this is set. I'm at home, I'm on set. I know how this works. Yeah, and you've done the prep, you know, the work all kind of catches up. I remember once doing a play several years ago. It was a wonderful Eugene O'Neill play, and I was playing this big, brawny, Irishman.
Yeah.
And I was eating steak and lifting weights and practicing this Irish accent and this and the swagger. And I'm walking around my house. I'm about 3 weeks into rehearsal and I suddenly think, what am I doing? Like, you fool. You sound like an idiot. You're trying to put on muscle you don't have. You know, but as talking about life earlier, the only direction was forward. It was like, I've got a couple of weeks left.
Yeah.
I better just keep going.
Yeah,
and trust
yeah.
the process. And it all worked out. I like to think it was a success anyway. But
what movie?
It was a play. It was called Anna Christie. It was wonderful Eugene O'Neill play. Yeah.
And you did a long run of that?
We did. That was a limited run in London at the Donmar Warehouse. So, you know, it was about 8-9 weeks.
And you got to prep for a month?
Couple of months.
Yeah.
Couple of months.
See, that's the thing about theater. Like, you know, just, well, there's never a point, though, because I have to do a show. I'm going to shoot a series in Vancouver. And I don't live an actor's life because I just like to be around my pots and pans.
Right.
I like to be, I don't even.
Literally,
have,
domestic.
Yeah. I don't have kids, but I got three cats. And right. part of me sort of like, well, what are they going to do? They're cats. And I'm still fucking my head up about it. But the idea of just going somewhere else, being detached and like living that life for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you like make yourself not lose your mind?
Well, nowadays it's simple. I'm with my family.
Oh, you bring them.
And before, there were periods of time when, so I've been married twice. My first marriage, there were periods during that period of my life when I was away a lot on my own, and it drove me crazy.
But you're just trying. You had to do it.
Well, I was working. I'm following, getting the job. I'm gonna, you know, the money's going home. It's going. You know what I mean? It's got to. I can't just stay at home.
But sometimes for months. Right?
Sometimes for months. I mean, we would never, as parents, you know, have it that the kids would be away. I wouldn't see them for months, but the weeks even when I wasn't with them. I'm kind of sitting there in these hotel rooms thinking, what am I doing? This is just miserable. On set, fantastic. It all makes sense. You're having fun. You're working. Sure. You're being creative. You're surrounded by lovely creative people and a team.
Yeah.
But at home, you go kind of nuts. So now I'm very lucky. You know, my family are with me all the time.
Yeah.
We made a choice to sort of travel together like nomads.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
And they have a good time?
Yeah. And this last year has been insane. We moved house in London.
Yeah.
The house is an old house, so it needs a lot of work. And so we've just taken jobs and traveled. We've been in France, we've been in Australia.
Who's doing the work on the house? You got people?
We've got a team, but it being England,
yeah,
we need endless sort of approvals and because there's certain
rebuilding permits.
And then certain parts of land that you're not allowed to change because it's an old historical piece of land and
bats in
certain trees. And I mean, honestly, the amount of loops and hoops I've got to jump through.
So, but that's now this is my issue. Now, isn't that in the back of your head all the fucking time?
All the time.
So you're checking your phone. It's like, it's the yard.
It's that again. Yeah. I call it plate spinning.
Yeah, right? Of course.
I feel like I have suddenly got 100 plates.
Yeah.
And I'm the guy running around.
But you keep it together, aren't you?
Just. Some days are better than others.
Yeah. So, okay. So
do you ever meditate? Have you ever started?
I tried.
And now, even though I don't like lose myself.
Yeah.
Just any excuse to be able to take 5-10 minutes and breathe.
You do it?
Yeah, really.
I was doing it during COVID for a while. You know, with the Headspace app.
Yeah.
And that guy's British, I think, isn't he?
There are options. In Headspace, the one where you get multiple choices of different people.
Yeah, maybe. But I thought I was always with the one guy. And you know, I would sit for 15 minutes, and I got it. It was good.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I get jacked up on coffee. Mm. And now I'm back on nicotine. Mm. And, you know, and I'm sitting around wondering, like, why am I so fucking stressed out?
And these two sitting there looking at you.
And I'm doing winking. Nothing. I'm doing nothing. And I know why. But like my brain's choosing that. So what am I going to do?
But don't you think, I mean, I'm realizing more and more, like life is this like balance. Like, I love to keep fit, but I love a glass of wine.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm thinking, well, you know what? I quite like this balance that I can have a glass of wine and
that's
feel
balance.
Guilt-free.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's and nine glasses of wine.
Well, sometimes it's nine glasses of wine. But then at least when I'm having a little workout in the morning, I feel like, okay, this is a healthy balance.
Yeah, I try
to get there. I'm putting in, I'm taking out.
Yeah, I try to get there. So tell me about this, you know, finding this honesty. So when you're growing up, you're watching Roth, Michael Caine from up the street.
Mm.
Do you know him?
Yeah, I've worked with him and I know him a little. Yeah, he's a wonderful man.
He's like the best.
Yeah.
And he just retired, supposedly? He's 100.
Well, supposedly. He is, nearly. No, he's 90-something, yeah.
You know, and...
do you know what I love about Michael? No one likes being Michael Caine more than Michael Caine.
Really?
He's like, I mean, he just loves the life he's led.
Yeah.
And he loves to share the experiences and the stories. And if you've got a story, if you went to the moon, he went to the moon before you.
Right, oh, really?
And tells you, yeah.
Oh, he loves to do that.
Because you'll go, I've got I had this wonderful holiday. Shall I tell you about a holiday I had? Right, and his holiday is always better than yours. He's a raconteur and a gentleman.
Yeah.
And
quite a career, right, though?
Yeah.
He's another guy, though, that, like, you know, he did the leading man thing. He can do it, but he's not beholden to it.
Yeah, it's true. And actually, I've not thought of that. Yeah.
And, you know, he's not a complete sort of transform. You know, he doesn't lose himself, but he's got these, you know, these varying degrees of intensity. He can
and never underestimate. You maybe should. I wonder whether it was as clear in the States as it is in the UK. He was pretty groundbreaking because you know, when he was coming through in the 60s, it was expected that you as a Brit had to lose your accent and become much more like, I've got a kind of middle class standard English accent.
Right.
Michael's obviously got that voice, right? And he never lost it. Now, if you look at his contemporaries around him, Terence Stamp, Albert Finney, you know, they all kind of knew, Tom Courtney, they all sort of leveled out their voices, and Michael kind of broke the mold by saying, "No, this is my voice. I'm sticking with it."
Yeah,
and it became part of who he was and his persona.
It makes him people who can do a good Michael Caine impression are very impressive, right?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
But like, I just remember. Did you ever see that movie where he played? He worked at an ad agency or something, and it was an indie movie. It was the one where he starts killing the people who were, you know, he wasn't getting promoted. And I can't remember.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, he's killing everyone above him. So he gets the next.
But in a way that like is very, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a great movie. I can't remember. You know, I'll look it up. But so how old are you? Like there's like, I just interviewed Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, yeah.
Dude.
Wow.
That guy's fucking. He's what a career. Lit up. But he's lit up. It's an interesting career because, you know, he did Clockwork Orange and that's it. In the way of
right?
But people remember those. Yeah. But he's been working, you know, 3 movies, 4 movies a year.
Yeah.
But like, he's never going to get out from under Alex in, you know, Clockwork Orange. No. And we talked about Caligula. But he's got these great stories. And it's my belief that it seems like, you know, in England, even with rock music, I'm going to interview Geezer Butler, who's the bass player from Sabbath. And I'm reading about them. It seems like within show business and within music, and I imagine other arts and whatever, there's a fairly small place, and everybody kind of knows who's doing what.
Mm.
Like, and I imagine that crew of British actors that you just talked about, you were probably, when you were a kid, like, they're amazing, and they're down the street. This all happened here.
Yeah. Actually, that's interesting. I think there was this crossover period when, to me, acting on film suddenly became a possibility. As a kid, you know, film was this other. Film was this other world. And then it was in my teens when I was aware of Gary Oldman's work, Tim Roth's work, you know, the history of or the actors who had come out of the area that I was growing up in. And then films by people like Stephen Frears and Mike Leigh, you mentioned earlier, that suddenly were also films that were of people I kind of knew, I grew up around.
Yeah,
I remember My Beautiful Laundrette or Meantime. And watching those and suddenly going, oh, film is also an expression of us, of me, of those around us. And that was a real light bulb moment where I suddenly thought it wasn't this other world, this alien kind of island that where people make movies. It was a potential avenue for me. Prior to that, it had all been about theater, really, and just performing on stage.
But even with like the older generation, like I mean there's a lot of the British films, like you mentioned Courtney, like the Long Distance Runner, you know, If, and then the Olivier stuff and all, and Pinter, like it's kind of brain bending. Or Joseph Losey,
I mean
what the fuck,
Joe
is
Losey,
that?
Yeah,
what is that?
Yeah.
You watch his movies and like, what am I watching? And that was sort of the art films of that time. But then I guess what you're talking about is when it shifted to, you know, kind of more working class depictions, you know, more kind of neighborhood depictions. Like guys like Mike Leigh, I guess, would be Daniel Day-Lewis, I guess, early on.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So you saw it. But when you started, you were all theater?
I was. Theater just seemed, you know, theaters were everywhere around me in London. You drive into town from where I grew up and you go over the bridge and there are theaters there, theater there. So you could see, you know, to me, getting a job in one of those seemed more realistic. It was like, oh, you know, that's where I want to get to.
Yeah.
And I was doing plays out of school and I was...
You were early on? So you were
always
into it?
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. From school and then, you know, youth companies outside of school.
Like Shakespeare?
A little bit. I've done that more in my adult career rather than as a kid. But
was it daunting?
Do you know, Shakespeare, to me, I always had this weird relationship with I just always got it.
You did?
I did. I don't know whether it was the way it was introduced, probably by my mum. I never they would take us to the theater a lot.
What did they do?
They were both teachers.
Oh, so well, that's
retired teachers now.
So that's supportive. That had to be kind of like, at least you got educated and
they made it fun. They made reading and going to the theater and watching movies and paint. My sister's a painter and they made creativity.
Oh, that's great.
A fun thing.
So you never thought, they never were like, you know, what the fuck are you doing with your life?
They never did that. They were super supportive.
What an amazing thing.
They lent on me emotionally in other ways.
Oh, yeah. And that's why I'm an actor.
Yeah.
I need approval from everyone else.
Exactly. Thanks, Mom and Dad.
I'll go over here to get liked.
Yeah.
But so they brought you to theater. So you saw Shakespeare. Because I have this ongoing thing, especially with British actors, where I'm always like, I don't get it.
Don't get it.
And Ian McKellen has done it to my face.
Wow.
Like
still you didn't.
No, I got it.
Yeah. He gave it.
He definitely.
Yeah.
To be this close
to
him. Wow,
I'm jealous.
Doing a monologue. But do you feel like you have that kind of stage training? Where'd you go to learn?
No, I kind of learned on the hoof, if that's the right term. Yeah. I did a lot of theater as a kid and then got employed in and did theater professionally from quite a young age. So I was doing stuff at from about 19 on. Yeah, there are a lot of it, in the same way in New York you have off Broadway. There are a lot of small theaters in London away from the West End, and I was doing plays in these little theaters above pubs or in back rooms and learning
experimental stuff, weird stuff.
Yeah, really weird stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't make any sense and someone's naked.
Yeah, a little bit of that. Trying to, as I remember. Yeah, quite a little bit of that.
It's like, I don't know what we're doing and where are my pants?
But it's theater.
Yeah, exactly.
It means something.
There's 9 people out there waiting to see this.
That was always the rule. If there are more people on stage than in the audience, go to the bar.
Really?
Do you know what I mean? Come on. There's 9 of us in the play and 6 of you. Let's we'll talk about it in the bar.
Believe me, I've done, that's with stand-up comedy, you have to deal with that.
Yeah.
And like, you know, how do you maintain a fourth wall when they're, like, how is the temptation to be like, do you guys just want to, we don't have to do this.
Yeah.
Where do you pick up, like, the craft? I mean, if you, because I've talked to enough actors and, you know, talking about craft is not necessarily the greatest thing in the world. But when you say you look for honesty in material, where do you start learning and who do you learn from to go to the depths that you want to go to? Or does that happen naturally as well?
Well, I guess nowadays it's a process that I've just accumulated over the years.
Yeah.
Stuff, boxes I need to tick and areas I want to go to make it just feel authentic. And it's a good excuse to read up and learn. And, you know, hopefully you've taken on board a character or a situation, a character that's in a situation that's interesting.
Yeah. But what about accents and stuff? I mean, do you...
So accents, that's an area, a technical area. You got to really, you got to do the work.
Yeah.
And be specific. It's not enough to go, he's American.
Right.
You got to say, well, what state, what street, where's his mom from, where's his dad from?
So you put that all in place.
Yeah, all that stuff.
You work with the dialect people?
Fantastic dialect coaches who train you up and get your mouth working in different
ways. And he gives you that little decoder sheet.
That's right, phonetics.
That's the whole thing.
And yeah.
But then
you walk around listening. I mean, one of my before The Order, Tim, who I work with on The Order, Tim, the great Tim Monarch, a kind of legend in dialect teaching, he gave me all these recordings of guys. So I wanted my officer to be from Buffalo, and so he found all these amazing recordings online of guys reading at funerals and guys giving speeches and people on the news, and so I walk around listening to these guys on my headset.
Yeah,
you know, hearing the sounds.
You feel like you got it?
I hope so. I mean, that's for others to say. But
I did that for the first time with that 2 Leslie movie with Riceboro.
Yeah,
yeah. And it was I didn't want to do it. I was like, because I don't see myself as an actor really. So this guy, this director, keeps pushing me. You know. He wants me to do it. And I'm like, well, there's a million, half cowboys out there. You know, go get an actor that can, just like be this guy. And he convinced me that he wanted me to do it because he liked my TV show. And I'm like, I'm not going to do the accent, though. It's too much. But then I thought, like, well, if you want to act at all, you better figure this out. So I got the coach.
How'd you find it? That process?
I liked it.
It's kind of interesting, huh?
But to your point, like she says, well, we'll do Lubbock, Texas, because there's not really a Texan accent.
Right, okay.
And I'm like, Lubbock? What the fuck is Lubbock? And then she sends me these links, and they're all of this old songwriter and singer and actor, Mac Davis.
Okay.
He's just an old dude, and it's like this behind the scenes Grammy interview that you know for the industry.
Which by the time you listen to it 40 times,
right.
You know off by heart, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, but it's just sort of like, you know, that's the only example. But I think it's interesting that he went and dug up just anybody in Buffalo, just regular people, to just find how this works. But I had to have that phonetic sheet in my trailer.
Oh yeah, me too.
To make choices.
Still as a guide, yeah.
Right.
Well, it's extraordinary that the muscles in your mouth are, you know, just programmed to fall in a certain way because of how you've grown up.
Right.
I remember, what was it someone told me once about that you, oh, I'm going to get the age wrong, and I'm going to disappoint Tim because he told me the story. I think your accent is sort of locked in by the age of 12. So say you're born in London,
yeah,
and you move to Michigan age 12, you'll probably pick up the Michigan accent and that'll be your accent.
Right.
But prior to that, you know, it's still forming. And so what we're talking about is literally training the mouth to operate in a different way or place it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy technical.
So
work.
When do you start doing, like, how do you get from theater? What were you doing to, you know, get the first break? Was it TV?
Someone saw me and offered me a job.
Yeah.
That was it. You know, the usual.
Like, what was it? What was the first job on set?
On a set, it would have been, so I did some TV as a kid, and then, yeah, a lot of theater. And on a movie set, it was probably, I did a little indie film in England called Shopping about car thieves. And then I did a film about Oscar Wilde. And then,
did you play him?
I played Bosie, the young guy who he got, his lover, whose father was the guy who took him to court and accused him of grooming Bosie and being a sodomite. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But my real break was I got offered a part in Gattaca.
That was big.
And that was a big break. That was the first time I went to Hollywood, and suddenly I'm there with Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman and Alan Arkin and Gore Vidal's in it. And yeah, that was a big deal.
Yeah,
and a real sense that things were moving in the right direction or in a direction.
Alan Arkin, the best.
Yeah,
he's so good.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I was going to just say effortlessly.
Yeah.
Of course, what we've just talked about is the work that goes in. I bet you there was a lot of work going on there.
Well, yeah,
but an actor, my kind of actor, in that you don't see it all work. You don't see all the workings.
Yeah,
it looks easy.
Sure, right. But just like, I'm sure, yeah, I mean, I talked to David Krumholtz recently, you know that guy?
Yeah.
And he does an Alan Arkin impression and he loves him. And he, just like, you know, off screen, you know, he was just as crazy as anybody, you know, and you know, kind of like, you know, neurotic and everything else. I think that acting is a great way for neurotic people to calm down.
I'm going to take that. I like that. No. I really know. I like that. It's so true.
Yeah. Because I realize that, and this is just me trying to put a craft together, is that, like, I know that I can't transform. Like, I'm not going to be fucking, you know, Dustin Hoffman. Mm. But I, you know, I can listen, and I have an okay presence, and, you know, I have an intensity. And I, you know, but you're not giving me a tremendous amount of hope that I can count on that, you know, in the sense that, like, it seems like if you're getting insecure or scared before you do a role, and you don't have the belief in yourself that, like, you know, I'm fucking Jude Law, I'm going to go be Jude Law. Like, how am I going to be like, well, Marc Maron, I'm just going to go out there and, you know, be who I am on some level. I realized with the character, like in Two Leslie, that, you know, it, for me, I have a spectrum of emotion that is me, right? And if I look at the script and I realize, well, this guy's not neurotic, so then I just figure out which parts of myself to turn off.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that seems to be a good chunk of it.
Yeah. But it's almost like there are two directions you can go in. And sometimes, you know, one direction is required more than the other, and sometimes both are required. And what I'm saying is, there's an emotional journey, right? So take Henry VIII. I mean, what the hell have I got in?
Dude.
How am I like in any way like him? But you go back and you sort of take away the fact that he's a king. You take any, and you learn or fill in the gaps if you need to, but learn as much as you can about what was he as a child? You know, what was he going through? What's the emotional infrastructure that created the man that he was?
So you're reading sort of dense historical biography?
Yeah, lots of fascinating biographies. But then what you realize, I'm like 10, I get obsessed. I'm like 10, 12 books in. The more you read, the more you realize, God, there are only a few facts here that all these books actually have, because this is 500 years ago.
That's crazy.
So they're all spinning their own perspective based on these, let's say, 25 specific touchstones. So you then yourself like are creating that emotional world. And like you're saying, you either you think, well, okay, there's a little bit of that. I know what that's like. I'll turn that up.
Right.
He's not got a lot of that. I'll turn that down.
Right.
There's that. And then there's the other direction I was talking about, which is, what does he look like? How do you play someone who is either like, you know, more muscly than you or more athletic or less athletic or more obese or, you know, whatever it might be. And you start leaning into those directions too, where you're creating a physical presence. So you've got an emotional presence and a physical presence.
Right.
At some point they meet.
And then you have to do the dialect.
And the dialect on top is I would put that with the physical journey, like trying to create the kind of physical presence.
But this movie, Firebrand, is like, it's one of those movies like that. It's a different approach to it because there's a realism now that I think that the director was going for. What was the director?
Kareem, yeah.
Kareem?
Yeah, well, he's Brazilian. And he knew what he liked about it as a subject was the thriller aspect. He liked the fact that how does this woman survive the danger of this man, this kind of monster, this Bluebeard figure. Yeah. And he wasn't so interested in the historical. He didn't really know an awful lot about Henry VIII as a kind of historical figure. And that's what I loved. It felt so refreshingly original, a perspective.
But it was very visceral in terms of the setting. Like, you know, that there is certain, there's not a lot of it, but even Monty Python did it well. That just the disgusting,
the grim
feasting and darkness and disease and food,
know, dark times, hard times,
And I mean, he definitely got that, But and also, you know, you've got this gangrenous wound that won't go away, and it's just like this festering pus and everything else. And she's this, you know, this beautiful ideological person, up against this monster, but also such grim times.
Yeah, hard times.
But I did realize at some point that they brought in a stunt ass. Did they?
It was Henry's ass.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say. It was Henry's ass.
I'm like, that's not Jude Law's butt.
it was, let's just say it was Henry's ass.
I think it went pretty well that you clearly, in terms of immersion, that maybe I'm projecting, but maybe you were vain enough to realize you weren't going to put on 150 pounds.
At some point, when I first started talking with Kareem about it, there were two roads. One was try to, and the other was that's just not going to be possible.
Yeah.
In the time I had, there was just no way I was going to be able to put on that weight.
But would you do it? I mean, at this point,
not that excessively, no. I mean, I let it go, and we did it in other ways, and gained a weight in another way, but never to that.
I thought it looked good. It worked. You know, it definitely worked. Mm. And you seemed massive. Mm. I mean, and I imagine that was somehow part of the physical portrayal of it, because you know,
but the clothes were so huge. Voluminous clothes.
Yeah,
and I mean,
yeah.
You know, we put on weights and padding and all sorts of things to kind of create the scale. And just the presence of the man. But, you know, it was talk about bling. They were wearing their wealth. I mean, we went to this extraordinary historical costumiere who was part sort of museum, part clothes makers. And so they were obsessed with clothes of that period. And they were making them and sewing them in exactly the same way. They were using gold cloth. They were, you know, all those jewels that were, it was basically Henry saying, look how rich I am.
Right.
I mean, everything was gold or rubies or, you know, the most expensive yarns brought in from Italy.
And was it heavy?
So heavy. And layer upon layer upon layer they would wear. Yeah.
And how were you sweating and just fucking
sweating like crazy?
Miserable?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Honestly, we didn't have a lot of time because we didn't have a lot of money, but we just all dived into the excess and the setting, and we were fortunate to shoot it all in one area, one castle. And we were all staying nearby in this little Derbyshire village in the north of England.
Yeah.
And it felt like a real group kind of obsession, you know. Just dived in, and the sweat and the pus was all part of it.
And the smell, that was another thing, like the smell, at some point. So when you were when you're breaking Henry down, what were the things that drove the character? He was tremendously paranoid,
absolutely. And paranoid that he, first of all, he didn't want to die.
Yeah.
And who does? But my point being, he I think was particularly scared at that point that he had to face his maker and answer for the many deaths that he was responsible
for. So when you read the stuff, you're like, he's a believer.
Well, he had used God. He saw himself as second only to God. He said he's known to have called himself God's secretary, right? He was so to him, God was
megalomaniacal.
Hugely.
Yeah. So,
but deluded. I mean, the poor guy. I mean, he'd been told so since he was a young boy.
Right.
You know, first of all, his brother was going to be king. He was probably told, well, you'll be Pope, or you'll be something else powerful. We'll get you in. Don't worry, son. Then brother dies. Suddenly you are king. And he's this glorious sort of 6-foot golden haired boy. Suddenly everyone wants to marry him around Europe. He's healthy. He's a great swordsman and a great rider.
Yeah.
And, you know, he probably didn't plan to have, numerous marriages. He didn't plan for all this disastrous love life and
killing a couple.
Yeah. Killing a couple and thousands more who disputed his power.
And so you knew you had to carry that. But also he was jealous and insecure and weird.
And then by the time when we get to the period that I played him, drunk and high on pain.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in agony. We spoke to doctors who treat people with these open wounds, these ulcers, and they're very hard to treat. But the idea that he had no anesthetic and no painkiller, nothing, is a miracle. He survived for 10 years with them, but he was drinking heavily,
Just a painkiller.
Just to try and numb the pain, yeah.
There's some moments in there, like where you have to, the sort of knowing that you would have no problem killing your wife.
Mm.
And for some reason, because of his vulnerability at that time, he kind of loved this one.
Mm.
That the weight of that, and those, like when you're working with, what was the actress's name?
Alicia.
She's great.
Yeah.
Right?
Alicia Vikander. Yeah.
So in those moments, like that moment where he's like, do you love me?
Yeah.
It was...
I know. But you see, you're asking about getting down to the sort of the touchstones of who he was. I decided early on that I think he was a bit of a romantic.
Yeah.
That you would think he was just this sort of bullish and non-feeling, egotist. I think he probably was all those things, but I think he kind of desperately wanted the love. He wanted to be loved.
In a real way.
In a real way. And somehow every time sort of thought, oh, well, do you love me? Yeah. Am I lovable? Please don't cheat on me, or don't lie, because then I'm going to have to kill you.
Yeah.
And I really quite like you, and I think he probably went through that almost with each one of the wives, maybe not Anne of Cleves, but because famously with Anne of Cleves, he just decided she was ugly. And he'd been sent a painting that he said was a lie. Actually, there's a great story about Anne of Cleves that Hilary Mantel writes about or tells that. So this is wife, I'm going to get this wrong, and I apologize to all historians. One, two, I think this is wife four. This is wife four. And so he's getting old, and they decide that he should marry this woman who's coming over, I think, from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
They've sent the picture. He agrees, and he decides he was a bit of a he liked joshing around Henry apparently. Yeah. So he dressed up as a commoner and rides down to meet her, and tells everyone, "Don't tell anyone that I'm the king." And she apparently slighted him on appearance.
Yeah,
and he just decided there and then get rid of her.
That's it.
That's it. That was it. Like, yeah, I don't.
It's hard to, like, to so when you play the honesty of that guy, you know he's a monster.
Yeah.
But the, I mean, the real goal is if you do your job and you find the honesty that there are moments where you're empathetic, even with the fucking monster.
And I think I don't know that you have to find the empathy when you play a character, but I do think you have to strip it all down and not be judgmental and play them. And that, again, so we come back to the word truth. You know, just play them truly rather than sort of leaning into I'm the monster. It's like, well, why? It's more effective to my mind when you see someone really portraying them honestly. Let the monster side just be, take care of itself. You know, if they're killing people, if they're tyrannical, if they are egotistical, if they're, you know, violent, whatever it may be, well, that's going to be in the DNA. You know what I mean? What our job is, like, make them real.
Yeah.
Because then they're more scary, you know?
Yeah, because you've made them, they're humans.
Exactly.
Yeah. As opposed to caricature.
Exactly.
But it just feels like now you're part of this, some sort of, like, I think is specifically a British tradition of actors playing kings. Like, it doesn't happen that often. But like it used to, it feels like it used to, like O'Toole and Burton.
Yes.
I think probably Olivier did a king or two.
He did.
And I think it probably comes through Shakespeare.
Yeah, maybe.
To sort of like create these historical epics. But like, but this one was fairly intimate. Like you didn't see, he came back from the war, which I think in back of the day, you know, that'd be half the movie.
Yeah.
Is whatever the war was.
Yeah.
But this was really a kind of a human portrait of the two of
them. Again, that was something that I really liked, Kareem's perspective. He was like, let's just see it as Henry and Catherine.
Right.
Like, it's just about this couple. Now, obviously, we have to pay respect to this, the time and the power that was being tug of ward over the religious effect implications of the time, but ultimately it's a domestic, and it's about a woman,
a hugely dysfunctional household.
I mean, apart from anything, they were never alone. That, you know, he was again paranoid, but also, I mean, the stuff you learn is just so mind blowing. So he would have a boy sleeping in his bed to keep his bed warm. You know, so when he was ready to go to bed, out, so he could get in and the bed would be warm. There would be someone probably in his room on call if he wanted to take a piss or a shit to take care of him.
Yeah.
But literally just standing there. He'd have guys around, like, the, you know, we have the radio nowadays, or we have Siri or whatever it is. Yeah. He would have musicians just standing by, because if he wanted a tune, he'd be, oi.
Well, that was sort of interesting part of it, because like, at any moment there was a guy with a lute or something.
Because he loved music.
And they were just like in bed with him and just hanging around.
Hanging around, because that, so he was also the creator of the, they say the middle classes, because there was the, Privy Council.
Yeah.
And then the Privy Chamber. And they were a group of people who had fought with him, that he trusted, that he wanted close, so that they could protect him and his advisors and so he could gamble with and get drunk with. And
Just have a party in the house whenever
all
he wanted.
The time.
So did doing, when you did Hamlet, right?
Yeah, on stage here, yeah. And in London.
So how old were you when you first did that?
34, 35.
And what did that experience reveal to you? Because that's sort of like a life-changing role, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I was looking back, it came into my life. Someone mentioned it to me and said, you should think about doing this. You're about the right age. And honestly, it just felt like, the time was right. The person that brought it to me was someone I trusted. And I think I knew myself well enough that if I obviously had a confidence that I could pull it off, but I also felt I didn't want to be the guy that got to a certain age and was like, damn, I wish I'd done that.
Yeah. Right.
And
it seems to be a rite of passage.
Yeah. So it felt like the right time.
Yeah.
And the right people around me who I trusted would guide me and not bullshit me and lead me in the right direction.
Like, what were you worried about in terms of bullshitting?
Well, you don't want to be in a situation like that where people are saying, you know, you can do this, you're great.
Yeah.
and you're not. You know, you're crashing your car every night.
Yeah.
So you know, you want to know that you're with people that are like A, going to guide you and say, okay, this is the area we need to work on, or this is the area that you could improve on, whether it's vocal technique or understanding text or whatever it might be, delivering those massive monologues. But I think, honestly, looking back, I'm just really thrilled that I did do it.
Yeah.
And part of me also looks back and thinks, how the hell did you do it? I remember, okay, I've never shared this before.
Yeah.
So we did 200 performances in total. We did a season in London, and then we went to Elsinore Castle, actually, in Denmark. And then we came to New York. And we ran it, you know, we did 5 shows a week, pretty much straight through. It was like 8 months or something. And I remember when I finished here in New York, and, you know, end of every night, you're like exhausted and sweating. And I got in the shower, and I remember I just wept. I was so pleased that I'd managed to pull it off. I'd done it. It was over.
Yeah.
But proud, you know, proud.
Yeah, yeah.
And happy that I'd managed to do it. And I don't know that it was one of the greatest. I don't know that it was the greatest production. It was a success. But I was thrilled that I kind of tested myself. And
pulled, you got through
just
it?
Just about got through
it. You were overwhelmed with emotion.
Overwhelmed, honestly. I guess that's, with relief, I think, also. But also, we were talking before, you know, about the exhaustion, the effort.
Yeah.
I think also it was just such a relief that I didn't have to do that show again 8 times a week.
It's like, that's like when we were talking about theater at the beginning, because I've thought about it and I talked to guys, you know, like I never, one of the funniest things that I ever heard about doing theater was, you know, David Harbour.
Yeah.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's a real fucking character, but he did a lot of theater, and we were just talking about, you know, that moment of like, I don't know my lines.
It's the nightmare.
It's the fucking worst.
Yeah.
But like, he did this impression of like, you know, he would be, one time he was about to go on. It was his entrance.
Oh, crap.
It was like 10 seconds.
It gives me, you see, this gives me the shakes. Yeah. I'm like,
he said, I'm 10 seconds away from going on. And he says, somebody give me the script.
That's right. Where's the fucking script? I've got to just check. I just want to check. Oh yeah. Okay. I do know what I'm doing. Awful.
Oh my God.
I remember once, during that run of Hamlet, we've done it so many times. I've tried to understand this, and I've never understood what was going on. It was this one night. Now, I think I'd been up a little too late the night before. I think I was a little overtired, but I was on stage. And obviously, I know it so well by then, because I'm like 5-6 months in. It's just coming out of my mouth.
But right.
I'm thinking, have I missed something?
Yeah.
Like, and I remember coming off stage saying to everyone, did I miss a bit? And they're like, no, it's great. It's going good. It's going good. And then I go back on and it's all coming out. And I'm still thinking, wait, I've got to slow down. Like, is this, am I on top of this?
Yeah.
Or is it just coming out of my, am I talking absolute crap?
Yeah.
And I'm looking at people and they're going, no, it's okay. Thumbs up.
You didn't fuck it up?
I dried, I think, twice. But I didn't dry. I remember
the lines don't come.
They don't come, and I just started
riffing,
and then it came back. Riffing in Shakespeare is pretty hard, let me tell you.
What's that moment on stage like where you're like, oh, I'm on my own?
All on my own, by the way, because you know, you're delivering a soliloquy to the audience
who know the fucking soliloquy.
That's the awful thing. Yeah,
they all know Shakespeare, and they're judging you because
what's that great? There's a great story of Mark Rylance says when he came on to play Hamlet, and he says, to be, and then the guy on the front row goes, or not to be. And then he looks around and goes, that is the question.
But is it like, you say it comes easy to you, but did you find, like, I mean, the people that love Shakespeare, they just believe that all questions are answered.
Well, wait a minute. When I say it comes easy to me, what I mean by that is, I've always
understood,
relished it, and I've always felt a general understanding of what it is. It's not like gobbledygook. It's
right,
not like a
right.
kind of a puzzle to be solved. I read it and I go, okay, there is a language here of a bygone time. There is a poetic perspective and embellishment, and I kind of got it. But Jesus, learning it and really playing it did not come easy.
Did you have to have a lot of work? Yeah. Did you have to have a Shakespeare guy?
We had an amazing guy who came, who was an expert, who helped us really fully understand the references and, of the time and then how to modernize them if we wanted. And,
oh, wow.
But,
oh, because there's little asides where you're like, what's he talking about?
Yeah. Sounds.
And, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. It could be anything, right? Yeah. Is that food? What is
yes.
he?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Right. So like, what is that?
Yeah, what is he
slang?
Talking about?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
They're usually some kind of pithy put down.
Right,
where he calls you a, I don't know, scrawny dog. I don't
Unbelievable.
Know.
And it, like, did you feel like, I mean, it must have been like that moment where you got overwhelmed with emotion. I mean, you're part of some sort of tradition when you pull off a Hamlet, like a global Hamlet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's true. You enter into a albeit a crumbling pantheon.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all kind of going away. But when over the course of the career, do you mark points where, you know, where you grew as an actor because of a specific, either another actor or a director's guidance, where you, like, you enter situations, like you did two movies with Anthony...
Minghella.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know...
Three.
Yeah. You work with David O... what's his...
David O. Russell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, were there... Who'd you learn more from, other actors? I mean, like, because if you're just coming at this and you're working with heavyweights, I mean, was there... I know you knew what you were doing and how to be on set, but were you like, oh, that's a good trick? You know?
Oh, endlessly. I mean, I think, honestly, you've just kind of summed up my approach and my whole career. I don't think there's been a single job where I haven't, even if I'm only subconsciously absorbing how people do stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, my lack of training early on was the reason I was all eyes, ears, all senses open to learning everything I could from anyone.
Right. But it didn't make you insecure? Or you think,
no, more just bloody curious. You know?
What's the trick?
And yeah. And absolutely, like you say, just that's a great trick. Or this is a... And that could be, just off the top of my head, whether it's someone like Minghella teaching me that, you know, if you're the lead, it's like it's your party. You've got to welcome people. You've got to make them... You've got to set the mood for the party you want. Don't be the guy who just sort of ignores the day... No, day players have got it hard. They come in, they've got to... one day, let's say, to play the cop in the room who's going to deliver. That's a really hard task. You know, we've been shooting for 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Yeah. You can't be like, who's this guy?
Ignore them. You know, set the mood. Give them an insight. Like,
you're the leader.
Right? You're the leader. It's your party.
But you have to be gracious.
Right. And take that seriously. That's a responsibility as much as just tipping up and being like, hey, I'm the leader.
Yeah, right.
You know, you set the tone.
Right.
Set the tone for the work expected, the pleasure, but the effort and all of that stuff. I remember that was an important one. But also watching, you know, the containment or the process of someone like... Sean Penn or Philip Seymour Hoffman, or, you know, you mentioned Dustin Hoffman. I worked with him on that O. Russell film. You know, how they, you know, they can be present and they're charming, but they've got their shit together and they're, you know, they're working. When they turn it on, you know, or what they're saving it for, when they're saving it for the close-up, they're saving it. All of those tricks, I've just been... Absolutely stealing.
Well, yeah, it's good.
But that's our job, right?
Yeah, it's a mental...
You know, take what you can.
Well, I mean, I heard someone tell me a story about Gene Hackman, you know, like, you know, been between scenes. And I don't remember who told the story, you know, but he seemed kind of like just casual between scenes. But he's like, I know how to fill myself up.
Yeah.
You know, that there's just a muscle.
Yeah.
That, but it doesn't overbearing. It's not, you know, it's just, I guess it's a focus. It's an intensity.
Yeah. Oh. And it's an on button.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember saying this to a young actor who, and this is the funny thing in our business. I guess it's the same in any, but I do feel like in our business, you know, have you got any advice?
Yeah.
If you got any advice? And I'm always like, learn your lines. Yeah. Be on time, be nice. But equally, I do remember saying this to this young guy once who I was working with, and he was burning up so much energy being chatty.
Yeah.
And being a nice guy. It was like, save some of that. Like, you don't have to be best friends with everyone, with the focus puller and the caterer. And just chill out. You got to save some of that energy and put it in the lens, because that's really your job.
Yeah.
You know.
Did it land?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think he knew what I meant.
And it all is about the script ultimately, isn't it? I mean, when, you know, because...
I guess so. Yeah.
I mean, you've got to integrate and trust the writer. And then there are moments where you're sort of like, well, I don't know about this.
Yeah. Exactly. I was going to say that.
Yeah.
The interpretation of the script is key. Like, are we all in the same space? Are we all interpreting this in the same
way? How often have you had to be like, I don't know if this guy would do this?
I've said that a few times.
Yeah.
And it's a nice moment. I feel like it's a wonderful moment that you
with
can,
the director?
With conviction, say, really?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
And like, do you negotiate? Like,
okay, what? Yeah. And, you know, if you've done your work and you can back it up, then it's a wonderful sense. I mean, I'm also...
Discovery, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To be able to be that committed and say, I just don't think he would behave like this or say that. Can we do it like that?
Yeah.
You know, of course, I'm also the kind of person who suddenly sits there thinking, maybe they're right.
Yeah.
Maybe I should just do it that way. Am I really that certain that this guy wouldn't do that? Maybe, can we do it both ways?
Yeah. Well, that's what they usually do. It's like, yeah, do one the way you want.
Yeah.
That's how they placate talent.
Snip.
Yeah. No, just go. Yeah, do it. Totally. That's a great idea.
Great directing, though, is also that lovely sense that you think you're coming up with all the ideas and then you realize you're doing exactly what they want.
And those are the good directors. You know, yeah.
Thinking, you get home and you go, hang on, was that what I wanted to do?
Was that what? Yeah. Because you have an idea. They're like, yeah, but maybe like.
Maybe like this.
Yeah, and then, oh, yeah. Okay, good. I came up with that. Yeah. Well, it's great talking to you, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to seeing the movie we're in together.
I'm excited for you to see it.
You saw it?
Yeah.
Is it done?
It's done. We are close to getting a distribution deal. It will be out probably by the end of the year. I'm very, very proud of it. It couldn't have been in better hands than Justin Kurzel. He's brought a real authenticity to it. Well, it's a non-judgmental film, but it really leans into the, you know, these patterns of misbehavior and disenfranchisement that seems so apparent today.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's the first real American domestic terrorist group.
That's right.
And did he use my radio stuff throughout the movie?
You're like an angel in it. Like your voice, Berg's voice is the voice of reason, and his death is very much the kind of pillar of everything turning and getting suddenly, oh shit, these guys really mean something.
Yeah.
And, or trying to make a hell of a statement.
Oh, good. I'm glad he used all that stuff.
The presence is in there. It's beautiful.
Oh, good. Because
you bookend the whole thing.
Oh, good.
And you come in the middle. Yeah. It's lovely.
Because he had me that night when he had me on the mics. He was just riding me. Like, do it again. Do make something up. Do it. Like,
it's really touching. It's really touching. And it's a kind of overview of just decency.
Yeah.
But there's a wonderful kind of almost like prayer that you say, did he use it at the beginning or in the middle? There's a beautiful where he just says, you know, be nice to people.
Right. I was in and out of that was one of those things where I'm like, I tried to do a little touch of Chicago, but I don't know if it stuck.
That's terrific.
It was good. Well, it was great working with you.
Yeah, and you.
Thanks. There you go. Good guy. Firebrand is playing in theaters now. Hang out for a second, folks.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
People, if you have a full Marin subscription, you can listen to the bonus episode I recorded in the car right after talking with Jude at his production office. We posted it on May 7th.
That is like one of the most attractive people I've ever seen in my life.
I know. When he walked in, I'm like, you're like ageless.
That's what you said to him. You were like, oh, hello, ageless man.
It's unbelievable. To get that episode and all the bonus episodes we do twice a week on The Full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's a lazy guitar riff that I think might be actually some elements of a Cat Power song. That's what I noticed after I did it. Thank you.
got angels everywhere.